Full of excitement.
All right. We're back with another episode of Ryan Seaman and Friends. And this week I have a gentleman that I've known, I think, close to 20 years now.
I mean, at least.
I did one of my first tours with this gentleman next to me. And if you're hearing this now, then I will have already been off the road and I just completed a tour with this fine gentleman, this guy. This is so weird for me to not be in the Adobe studio and just be recording this like somewhere else.
It's you got to mix it up sometimes, though. Yeah, you got to keep it.
Yeah. So
that's the mix it up sound, by the way.
That is the mix it up.
Yeah.
Sound.
Nobody could see the hand gesture, which was the mixing gesture.
Yeah.
But the sound, they were like, I wonder what that means. So well, that's the mix it up.
So I got Scott Kloppenstein, everybody. How you
Yay!
Doing?
I'm good. Yeah, I apologize. Good. Today was just a. it was a wacky morning. I will say I'm not typically a late individual. I don't like being late. I actually like being far more early than anyone should be. Because I usually like to get somewhere and like read or chill, you know, whatever. Listen to Beyonce. And that's what I was listening to on the way over here. It's just a good way to get pumped. Yeah. Like homecoming. What? Come on.
Yeah.
But there was a lot of like, I need you to empty the dishwasher, load the dishwasher, wipe down the stove, that kind of stuff.
It's all good, man.
You know, cause these are the things, this is my life now. It's rock and roll.
Well, I'm just happy to be here. You know,
I'm just happy
that, I'm able to come down here. We're going to jam a little bit.
We are. That's
and,
for sure.
And, for those of you that don't know this, you know, Scott has a band called the Littlest Man Band. I've known him before that, but I want to talk about your life just as a musician, because I think that all of us kind of have the same path, you know, just for better or worse. What I was going to say is, like, when I got started in music, I was like, you know, I was in middle school, and that's when I really, well, it was more like, maybe it was like late elementary school, is like when I picked up drums and like bass and stuff like that. And I really just started getting into like alternative and punk rock and ska music and just, you know, hardcore, whatever. It was all under this like one umbrella for me.
Right.
And, you know, from there, just my life took a wild, you know, took a wild journey. Music is what brought me here today, like with you. So, I mean, like, can you kind of take me back to like when you got started with music? And
well, my family's musical, like everybody in my family plays a lot. They sing a lot. Yeah, so music was just kind of always around.
Okay.
And it wasn't anything that, like it was dope. We had a great time, and, like the family would get together, and, like, you know, my parents grew up in the late 60s, and so it was, like, you know, playing, getting together and singing folk songs and stuff like that was, like, the dope thing to do. And so that was what we did. Like, we got together and sang, like, even in my, like, you know, in the 80s. And forever, this is what we always did. We did this, I mean, when, you know, So
you've always been around music.
Always been around. It was always really important. Okay. But I just never really, like, I guess I didn't realize that a lot of people's families didn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you're engrossed in this environment, and you don't realize till much later. I mean, you know, because I wasn't the most, shall we say, socially suave.
Okay.
So I didn't like get an opportunity to encounter a bunch of other people's family experiences.
Okay.
And so it was just like, oh, and I didn't realize it was anything special.
Mm-hmm.
Were unique. I was like, this is what we do. This is what my family does. So, you know, you get into your teens and you're like, oh, I don't want to do this anymore. It's stupid. Like, I want to go and sit at a coffee shop and talk about Camus. And, but then when I got into like junior high, actually when I got into high school, I met some people, and they were like, ooh, what you do with this thing is awesome and interesting. And I was like,
what were you playing at the time? Because you play like a bunch of different instruments.
Right. So, I mean, what I started learning to play, because everything I kind of picked up on my own, but the first thing I started learning to play was the trumpet.
Okay. Because
my grandfather was a fantastic trumpet player. And when he passed, my grandmother one time, she said, oh, the one thing I'll miss is listening to your grandfather play trumpet. And I was like, oh, well, I'll do it then so she can hear somebody play trumpet.
Okay.
And so, yeah, I mean, I picked that up in junior high, along with like French horn and the euphonium, mm-hmm. and like I kind of buzzed around to a couple different things.
Okay.
But then, yeah, I went to the Orange County High School for the Performing Arts for trumpet.
Oh, no way. Okay.
Which I got into kind of by accident. But I wanted to go, and the person who normally interviews the instrumental music people was mm-hmm. not there. So I think it was either a visual arts teacher or a dance teacher. And they were like, well, I think you sound great and you seem really like you want to be here. So awesome. Wow. Because I would not have gotten in had it been the actual person who was supposed to be there. So it was this weird, like, kind of serendipitous thing. And that's where I met, like, Aaron Barrett.
Okay.
I met Jesse Wilder. I met, you know, all of these mm-hmm. cats that are, like, now my oldest and dearest friends.
So you guys all went to this school together?
Yeah, it was Los Alamitos High School in uh-huh. Southern California, but on the Los Alamitos campus, they hosted OSHA. Aaron wasn't in OSHA. I can't remember if he tried to get into visual arts, but he knew a lot of visual arts cats, because Aaron's a fantastic artist. A lot of people don't know that.
Yeah.
But so I was in the instrumental music program and not doing well because it was a lot of like really serious jazz and classical people. And I was like, that's not my bag, babe. Like, yeah. I'm like I like weird.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, and I'd already been exposed to ska music at that time. So okay. like I was already like thinking, you know, like I heard Fishbone when I was in seventh grade. Mm-hmm. Fishbone, No Doubt, like the Specials, like all this stuff. So I was like, dude, this is incredible. And so, yeah, I didn't fit. And so they were going to kick me out. Mm-hmm. And then I auditioned for the musical theater program and got into that.
Okay.
So, that's where I met like Jesse Wilder who was in the Scholars, was in a band called Teen Heroes, was in the original Littlest Man Band lineup.
Okay.
Has a great band right now called Blue Ox. Yeah.
So, I mean, so going from there, I mean, so it sounds to me like you went to high school, you learned all the stuff. Like what happens next in your, journey?
So in sophomore year, I met cats that like were performers and into musical theater and stuff, but they were also into the growing ska scene that was in Southern California.
So it was like it was exploding around that time then,
kind of,
right?
Yeah, kind of. Okay. No, I mean it was still like a little tiny thing. I mean we were still playing like tiny little clubs or uh-huh. coffee shops or what have you, but sometimes I mean like you would go see No Doubt and it was like 300 people at a gig and mm-hmm. you're just like, whoa.
Yeah.
They're fucking famous.
Yeah.
And you're just like, wow. Yeah. Like I remember going to, they did when Tragic Kingdom came out or mm-hmm. Beacon Street. I can't remember. We went and saw them play an in-store at Bionic Records.
Mm.
But the one in like Fullerton, was it Bionic? No. Yeah. Was it? I don't remember. I think it was Bionic, okay. But it was packed.
Yeah.
And it wasn't what people then grew to know, like No Doubt to be.
Sure.
You know, like they
so
were still.
It must have been a Beacon Street thing, because I feel like.
Well, no, because they recorded, they did, if I'm remembering my history, they recorded Tragic Kingdom,
mm-hmm.
and then Tragic Kingdom got shelved. So they then went and recorded Beacon Street out of heartbreak. From working so hard, and then Interscope bought.
You're kidding me!
They were on Atlantic or they something.
Yeah, Interscope, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. There was something that traded over, and so it's like they, as far as I recall, it got shelved, and then even when it came out, it didn't get the big push because nobody mm-hmm. knew what to do with it.
Sure.
And it took a while for Tragic Kingdom, and then once Tragic Kingdom like. Caught on,
yeah.
Boy, oh boy!
I was gonna say I was pretty young when that record, when I learned about the record.
Yeah,
you know, I was like, I don't know, this is like maybe like 94, 95, something like that.
But yeah, I mean, we would go see No Doubt, and there was like again 300 people, and you're like, mm-hmm. wow,
that's fucking nuts.
That's
so I mean,
amazing.
So when did like real big, you know, I always hated like talking about. I mean, I shouldn't say hate. That's you know, I always want to bring the story around to, like, you know, how you got, you know, to where you are. So, I mean, when you're going to these schools and stuff, I mean, like, when did you guys put Real Big Fish together? When did that all happen in your life? Was so that, like, one of your first bands, or was that, like...
Well, yeah. So, well, kind of.
Okay.
I mean, I met Aaron my freshman year in high school. There were these cats that were doing a leapfrog kind of thing across campus.
Okay.
And I would sit by myself for lunch because I had no friends. And I saw this, like, group of people leapfrogging across campus, and I was like, what is this? And then this woman, who's a friend of mine now and, like, the wife of Dan Regan, the trombone player, from, her name is Monica Bumate, she said, hey, you can join in. Like, she saw me just watching, and she's like, hey, join in. Like, get in here. And I was like, okay. So I started leapfrogging. And the person who was, like, leading the charge to leapfrog was Aaron.
Okay.
So, I mean, it was like a 30-person leapfrog.
How old were you guys at this?
I mean, it was my freshman year in high school, so I don't know, 14?
Uh-huh.
And, you know, Aaron's a couple years older than me. That may have been Aaron's senior year, so...
so funny.
But, yeah, like, so we were leapfrogging across campus, and that's where I first met Aaron. And then there was a school carnival, and the original band form of Real Big Fish performed there. And it was like a kind of funk sort of REM, like, I don't know. It was a thing. And you can hear, I mean, you can hear the stuff online.
Okay.
It's, and it was like a different, Aaron was just a guitar player. There was a different singer. But, like, Matt Wong was still in it. Andrew Gonzalez was still in it. And then there was another guitar player named Lisa Smith, and then Ben Guzman, the singer. And so, and then, a keyboard player, and I don't remember Zach's last name. And I don't know if they had the trumpet players, the horn players at that point. Okay. But it was a pretty big band. Uh-huh. And I saw them and I was like, I want to be in this band. This is the coolest thing I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. And then that kind of dissolved. And so my first band that I was in was a band called The Scholars with some friends of mine from La Salle.
Uh-huh.
And some of those guys went on to be in the original lineup of The Littlest Man Band.
Mm-hmm.
And from getting into The Scholars and into the ska scene, I then joined three or four other bands because, as a horn player, everybody needs horn players. And I have a good head for music and memory.
Yeah.
So I could hold the places of all the songs and learn a bunch and not need a bunch of hand-holding. And I was always down to play.
Well, it also sounds like, you know, drummers and horn players are a... you know, it's a hot commodity. Because, I mean, even with me, I was growing up playing in, like, you know, three or four bands at once. I just thought that's what you did. Like, when I was growing up in Utah, I mean, there wasn't really anybody, like, in my hometown.
Right.
You know, so I had to go to Salt Lake City in order to find the people that could, like, play and had a scene and something. So Utah had a really great scene. And they had a really good ska scene, too. Which was, like, unbelievable.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know.
I mean, I think that's the story, though, with so many great... I mean, I think people have in their mind that it's, like, you meet these cats, and these are the ones, and you go out and conquer the world. But it's, like, you think about, you know... So many of these bands, especially drummers, it feels like, or guitar players, or any band member, I guess, will come along from something else, and they're like, "Oh, I was playing in this band."
Yeah,
you know, watch any music documentary, and they're like, "We saw this cat playing with this other country rock blues band."
Yeah.
You know,
for sure.
And so, that's where that all, I mean, I was playing in The Scholars. I was playing in a band called The Knuckle Brothers. I every now and then filled in for this band called The Goodwin Club. And then I was in Real Big Fish. I don't know if there
Here's
what
I got to
say. Oh, and then I played drums for a while in a band called, in the band
You're
Teen
a drummer?
Heroes. I played drums in Teen Heroes. I was the first drummer for Teen Heroes, yeah.
You mean I went on tour with you already and I didn't know that you were a drummer?
Oh, yeah.
You know, we already spent all this time together in a van.
Oh, I loved playing the drums. I loved it. Well, we had, the Scholars had this show. Yeah. I actually just found the pictures from this. We had this show where our drummer and our guitar player didn't want to make it to the show because it was a, like, winter formal night. And then the rest of us were like, I don't care if it's winter formal. We'll play the show, then go to winter formal.
Yeah.
So since we were trying to figure it out, I was like, I'll just play the drums.
Mm-hmm.
And so I borrowed a friend, my friend Greg's my friend Greg Coddington. I borrowed his drum set, and I mean, it was. I set it up in my room. I didn't have a big room as a child, and you could hear me playing and practicing, like far and wide, because I hit hard.
I had a ska band, you know, and we would all practice in my house in a room. Probably, I'm looking in here, probably half the size.
Sure, sure. Know?
Eight of us. I think there's eight of us in the band. And then there was like a trumpet player that would like kind of come and go whenever he wanted to. But we had two trumpet guys, you know. And God, we were just we were a mess. But we were a little fast. And we were called Just Add Water.
Just Add Water. We've talked about this.
we did talk about this.
Great ska band.
Yeah.
You know.
Great name.
Yeah.
So but it's just so funny how bands come together. So from you playing with all these bands, well, I was going to say, you're telling me you're having to memorize all these songs as a trumpet player, but what I've noticed is that, like, trumpets aren't playing, like, you know, the entire song. They're maybe, like, doing, like, a part of it. So, to your point, that'd be really, not easy, but, like, easier than, like, I don't know, like a drummer having to remember every, yeah.
Well, yeah, so, I mean, that was, it was always melodies and patterns. I can just keep them all tight and remember them. And it's only three buttons. You know, and as long as you remember
a little slide, maybe sometimes, right? Okay.
But it just made sense. It was just easy. And I always came into things when somebody got grounded.
Okay.
Because we were all in high school. So when Tavis Wirtz and Dan Regan got grounded, Aaron swiped Grant Barry and myself from the Scholars into Real Big Fish.
Wow.
And then when they got ungrounded, we had a four-piece horn section plus our saxophone player Adam Polakoff, and that was five. And we were like, and Aaron was like, "That sounded great."
Yeah,
and it did not. We have recordings. I was like, "Oh boy, we were so hermy and out of tune, and just playing as loud as we possibly could." But that was the fun of it.
Yeah,
like nobody cared. Nobody cared. Everybody just wanted to dance and have a great time, and so we played our little hearts out. But I joined Real Big Fish in 94.
Okay.
Yeah.
So from there, I mean, like, you guys are just playing as a local band. Like, how long do you guys think you were playing as, like, a local band before, you know?
I mean, a long time.
Discovered, quote unquote, discovered by the, by the machine. When did you start noticing, like, oh, this is going to be, like, a real thing, you know?
Well, it's always slow. It, like, creeps up on you. We would play more and more shows, bigger shows, you know, where you're playing a small thing like Cafe Nove, which was a little tiny place. It was a dance studio that they would, like, have shows in at night, but only really held, like, 50 people, maybe.
Slam them in there.
Yeah, like, and it was dangerous. And then the next thing you know, you're, like, headlining the Barn in Riverside, or you're doing the Ice House in Fullerton, which is no longer there, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
And then we start doing stuff in LA, like the Troubadour,
yeah,
the Whiskey, the Roxy, stuff like that. And then when you start heading out of town and playing bigger shows and more people start showing up, that's cool. But you don't really know. I mean, we worked so much and it all happens slowly. But also kind of quickly,
right?
Like, it's this weird slug because you're doing it every day and you're engrossed in it and you're focused on the work, right? But you kind of don't notice that it's like the back of the room starts filling up as you're playing these gigs. So you're going to Santa, you're getting out of town and doing things. I mean, to be honest, I feel like we didn't even really so. I think we were talking about this last night at rehearsal.
Yeah.
When we went out on our very first 6 to 7 week tour to support
Let's Go Bowling
and the Cherry Pop and Daddies.
Which is also mind blowing to me.
But yeah. So it was Let's Go Bowling headlining, Cherry Pop and Daddies below them, and then we were the opener. And through about the middle of the tour, Sellout hit MTV, which was still important back then.
Right. Oh, yeah.
And the next thing you know is people are coming to see the opener and leaving afterwards. And we felt fucking horrible. Like, we were just like, oh my, like, what do we do? So they flipped us to the headliner.
That's so insane.
They had to change a bunch of the art. I mean, the promotions had to change all this stuff and money and stuff.
Yeah.
And we felt so bad because we had so much respect for these two bands, but it was what was... not personal, it's business thing, right. Which, you know, I think is something that we use in this country as a way to act like pieces of shit. But in this situation it's like, I don't know.
Yeah.
And the Cherry Pop and Daddies had their comeuppance, and, like, you know, they had their moment in the sun too, and they were huge. They did great.
Yeah. I remember seeing them at the Palladium.
Yeah, you know? It's like, yeah, they were fine. So yeah, we did that tour, and then I think it was at the end of that tour, we were ready to go home, mm-hmm. and somebody said, no, you got to go play this festival, this radio show, which mm-hmm. we'd never done, in Connecticut. And we were like, oh, my God, we just want to fucking go home.
Sure.
Like, we missed loved ones. And they were like, no, this is important. So we drive to this thing in our van, mm-hmm. in our frickin' van.
Yeah,
there's
yeah.
buses everywhere.
Oh my God.
We pull up in our little Rudy Toot Toot van that's taking us all over the place. You know, our crew, like, we had a crew at that point. Mm-hmm. But all I know is that we're backstage, we walk past, and, like, the guys from the Offspring go by, and they're like, hey, man, what's going on? We're like, what? Did you say hey to us? What's happening?
That's
and then
awesome.
So we go into this dressing room backstage. And we're like, oh, what is happening right now? And then they're like, okay, Real Big Fish, you guys are on. I mean, we hadn't been there like an hour and a half to 2 hours. I mean, we just
and
we were like, okay.
Yeah.
I mean, we were so out of it too. And we, you know, I mean, there was backline and the whole thing. Mm-hmm. So we got, and we walked, and we turned the corner. We went past the curtain, and it's like 14,000 people.
Oh, my God.
Freaking the doinks out
as we
hit the stage, and we're like, what is going on?
So maybe that was like the moment where you're like, okay,
that for me is like one of the greatest moments of my career, where you come out and they're just screaming, and we're exhausted.
Right.
We are like, no, we don't know what to expect. Mm-hmm. We hadn't seen the crowd at all. We just went straight from the loading dock and back into our dressing room, which was cool to have.
Yeah.
And it was clean and there was food and what have you. And and then we come out. I mean, it's like so many people, and we felt like, I can't speak mm-hmm. for everybody else, felt so crazy.
Yeah.
Because all of a sudden, I am the most tired I've ever been in my entire mm-hmm. life. I then all of a sudden have the most energy I've ever had in my entire life. I then am also the most terrified I've ever been in my entire life.
Oh, man.
I smell bad. My body hurts. I think I had, for the first time really in my career, a beard. And, like, probably dark sunken eyes and what have you.
Yeah.
And but I was just like, what? And we went out there and we crushed for 30 minutes.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, we went back to our dressing room. I don't remember what happened after that.
I love that. Well, dude, this is a perfect opportunity to go to a quick commercial break.
Quick commercial break.
That we have to do here at Idobe. But we'll be right back with Scott Kloppenstein.
I love it.
Oh man, Scott, that was such a crazy story. Why didn't you tell me that earlier?
I don't know. It just pops into the brain.
I always do that when I come back in.
It works. I like it. No,
it's like a little Andy Kaufman kind of.
You want people to feel like they really.
Yeah, I really don't know what to do. I'm kind of a social, in my eyes, maybe not other people's eyes, I feel like I'm like a socially awkward person.
Sure.
So I don't know how to come back into a show. Like, well, I guess we're back.
I don't know.
We're yip yapping.
Yeah.
Doodadding, you know?
I mean, that when I have my on my Twitch thing, I do the same thing where it's just as it's like, you know, you make some sort of joke as in like, you know, it's like, just let me know when we're back.
All right.
And then I just stare into space.
And then you
and G Scott's like, we're back. I was like, that's right. Just let me know when we're back. Yep. That sort of thing.
I love that. All right. So we're at the point now, I think, in your career.
Yeah.
Where you just start to see being a musician maybe pays off. In some sort of way. Are you guys successful at this point yet? Are you able to like pay bills yet? Or I mean, there's fucking seven of you or something on the road.
Yeah,
right?
I mean it was like
at that point there was like seven guys in the
band. When we first signed to Mojo Records, which was the label that we signed to, mm-hmm. Thanks to John Feldman.
Sure.
Who found us and was like, yo, we gotta, you know, get
we
you guys
do this.
Doing this.
Yeah.
I'll never forget. Seriously, it was like I thought I was going to lose my mind because I was an 18-year-old kid with zero prospects of, like, I mean, I was getting ready to go to college and, like, but I didn't know what I wanted to do. So I'm like, I'll study, like, the history of architecture from the beginning of recorded time to, like, you know, and then a film is literature class, which you just sat and watched movies. And then I think I took some other classes. I don't recall. I
You were in college. When
I was
happening?
In college. When things started. But then they were like, "Hey, we're gonna pay you $400 a month."
Wow!
And I'm like, "What? Are you at for sure? Seriously?
That's
you
mean what rent was back then, too?
I was like, maybe, you mean I could buy my girlfriend dinner?
Yeah,
that's amazing. Because I was also I had like." A few jobs, and I think at that point I was the house manager for a stage theater called the Gem Theater in Garden Grove. And so I was, I would just sit in my office, and I was the guy who would open it up and close it down. Like, I didn't really do much. And then they're like, $400. I was like, in 1995. $400 was actually...
That's probably like what today? Maybe like $1,500?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, like you definitely could... Yeah. I mean, my rent... Yeah, what was my rent when I finally got my own place? I rented a room in a friend of mine's condo.
Yeah.
And I think, my rent was $400.
That's crazy, man. When I was in this band, I Am Ghost, there were six of us.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember from the time it started until the time it ended... Whether we were on tour or not, I made $600 a month.
Wow. Amazing.
You know? But I mean, back then, that paid my rent and, like, maybe a cell phone bill.
Yeah,
or,
yeah.
Like, you know, internet or something.
Oh, I mean, it was like we got, you know, it steadily went up.
For sure.
Well, because we then got, like, then all of a sudden I learned about publishing and what that all meant. And it's like, you know, I was a contributing songwriter to Real Big Fish. And so it's like all of a sudden I got weird checks out of nowhere. I'm like, what the, what is this? Mm-hmm. And they're like, this is your money. You worked for it. You earned it. And I'm like,
okay.
All I did was write a song. And they're like, yep, you get paid for doing that. I was like, wait a second.
Yeah.
That's wait. So I write a song. I help write a song.
And you get paid to perform it, too.
And
sometimes.
Get paid to perform it.
Yeah, if you're not a writer.
Well, and as a singer, too, because it's like, and that was the hard thing. There was always the, Real Big Fish was very communal in that way with a lot of things with publishing, is it's like we would break things down the way they were, but we would try to make sure that it was as evenly distributed as possible so that everybody got a bit. But once the stakes started getting real serious, we had to rethink that. And so there was like, we changed the structure of things so that, because there's always that argument, right? Like you show up to, and we did a lot of pre-production. We worked really hard. And so if you show up every day to pre-production, you're in a studio 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. We treated it like a job. Like just, you know, you're playing your instrument, which, you know, you get your mechanicals, but like part of that is part of the song, part of the decisions you make, part of the fills, part of the this, that. And so we decided there was a way to distribute how things went out because that's absolutely
cool,
important. You know, like, I mean, I can write a song, but everybody who plays it and participates in it, participates in the recording, in the rehearsal, in any of it, the demoing process, gives something that helps shape it. You know, and if you're in it for the long haul, which we were, then that needs to be recognized. And
So
that's how certain things were put out and broken up. And so, things started to roll. But I mean, I feel like it's a cliche. You still don't notice how I'm a malcontent. So it's like I don't. Once I reach a certain place, I'm always like, what's next?
Yeah.
Like, I can write a song and be stoked on it for about 10 seconds, and then I'm like, I can do better.
Yeah.
This is garbage.
Okay.
Like, I see all the things I did wrong. Let's move forward. And And so with touring and like being in the band, it was always that, like, we did this thing, what's next? Where are we going next? There was very little time to stop and go, wow, this is cool. Right. Like that moment at that show in Connecticut, that was a stop you in your tracks moment. But most of the time we were so busy and working so hard that we didn't really have the time to pause. And then you go home and everybody's different. You've been gone so long and you're just trying to get yourself back into some sort of
Normalcy.
Yeah, some sort of normalcy, trying to figure out where and who your friends, you know, and you're just like, what the doinks? Yeah. And and then you got to go again, right? Like you're trying to like spend time with your girlfriend so she doesn't leave you. And you're trying to figure out, you know, if things have been weird since you left. Interpret that how you will.
Yeah, I was going to say being on tour, my favorite things were playing shows, seeing the country, fighting with my girlfriend.
Oh, man.
That was like, you know?
Well, and
I'm being sarcastic, but it's just like.
I mean, I always had girlfriends. Yeah. So it was like, and so, yeah, you're always trying to convince someone not to leave you.
Yeah.
You're like, I'm coming back.
Yeah, it's only like 2 more weeks.
Yeah.
Like, let's just count the days.
Well, and I mean, this is something my wife
it's not normal, though. I mean, like, we think it's normal because, like, we do it, you know? But the average person, they just go work their 9 to 5 and they come home and sleep in the same bed and have a shower and do the, you know? And it's like, for me, that's just, like, not how my life has been for more than half my life.
Sure.
You know?
And it's, well, I struggle with any type of idea of normalcy, right? Like, I feel like that's a setting up of expectations that are that we're just incapable of fulfilling. That's a way to always be disappointed in everything, is to search for some sort of fucking normalcy. And I know that sounds pretentious. Maybe I'm pretentious. I feel like I may be. I am. But no, I think this kind of veers off into a different area, but this is such an issue for people, I think, is this idea, it's a trap. It's a fucking farce. Mm-hmm. Normalcy is ridiculous. Like, we want to qualify, quantify, and put some sort of controllable value system on the elements of our life instead of realizing that security and safety are illusions. Like, there's no such thing. It's all about the moment. And like, if we're worried about what's coming and what's been, then we're missing out on the now.
Yeah.
And
it's a hard time with that.
And we're fucked. No. Like, that was part of the thing that we were missing out on the now because we're like, okay, what's the next thing coming? What's the next thing coming? And that's why playing was the best.
Right.
Because when you're playing, you're nowhere else.
That 45 minutes or whatever, an hour is just like, that's the best part of like the whole deal.
Oh, I mean, that's the whole, we were talking about this yesterday again. It's how I practice and experience gratitude and oneness and really life. Like, it's the one time I feel like my feet touch the ground and yet my spirit and my soul are able to like connect with something bigger, something beyond my personal ability to quantify or control, or put into some like tangible box or, you know, play on my iPhone. It's like this ethereal thing, right? Cause you're moving air from one place to another, or you're experiencing the movement of air. And so, there's this great, article or essay by Leonard Bernstein, where he talks about the amazing infinite possibility of music, and how it sets itself apart from other art forms because it is an intangible thing.
Sure.
You can't touch it. You can't hold on to it. You can record it.
Right.
But then even it's still the transition like a, of what that is coming yeah. at you is still something you can't touch.
Yeah, it's still a moment in time.
Yeah. But I don't know how we got there.
No, I think we were talking about like how it's just always go, go, go when you're how your life has just been go, go, go. So
yeah.
At what point, so this is like the only, so for me, I've been in so many different bands, but like my role in these bands have been mostly, you know, my career for the better half is it's kind of like a Josh Freese, you
right.
know, where it's like I kind of just help, you know, the band get to where they want to go. And then if I'm a part of it, cool. And if I'm not, also cool.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
know, that's been my career. So for you, just being in one, you know, being in one band for so many years and being a big contributor, I mean, like, how does that lead? You know, maybe this is for like the next commercial break or something, but I'm wondering, like, at what point were you touring with like Real Big Fish like so long, and then you're like, you know what, I can't do this now, and then I need to focus on Littlest Man Band. Like, what, where was that transition? Where are we in the scope of Real Big Fish right now? Like,
I mean,
are touring, you're getting successful, you're,
yeah. So I mean, I always had kind of
gone a lot.
I always kind of had side projects, which was a way of for me to like reconnect with friends, you know. And it's like, so we'd be home and I put together this project called Pal, which was like a 4-piece.
I remember that.
Yeah. Sonic Youth meets the Beatles and Beach Boys. Fugazi. Just a
bunch of, yeah.
just rad. Like, it was just, I mean, seriously, some of the most fun I've ever had. And we all had pretty high tolerance for substances. Uh-huh. And so we did that for a while, and we made a record with John Avila, who produced the first two Real Big Fish records. And so I had that, and I would play shows with that when I was home.
Cool.
And then Real Big Fish kind of needed a little more attention, so that kind of fell to the wayside. And I feel like that was during Cheer Up. Like, Cheer Up was a laborious record. We did 6 months of pre-production, which we'd never been home that long. And then the record kind of took a while to record as well.
Never been home 6 consecutive months?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. That sounds like me almost. I was trying to do some math. I think since the year 2006, I think the longest I'd been home before like the pandemic and stuff, I think it was 8 months. So yeah, that's
I mean, we were generally on the road 6 to 9 months out of the year. I mean, at least like 8 to 9 months out of the year.
Yeah.
And especially when Europe opened up and the UK opened up for us and overseas, I mean, in Japan and Australia and New Zealand. And so, yeah, I mean, there was just always, you know, you do your primary markets, secondary markets. We did third markets, you know, we tried to go everywhere.
Yeah, you did.
And that's in, you know, the U.S. you do 3 tours in the U.S. a year, and then in between those you throw Europe and the U.K. and
did you guys ever get to go to South America? Did you ever go there?
We did. We only no. Yeah. Oh wait, yes. Sorry. Wow. Yes. yeah.
It all
no, we
in
did
together, man. I know.
We did Brazil, Argentina,
Chile.
Yeah, we did Chile, and then I think that tour was the one where we did. Yeah, we did Brazil.
Yeah, you're
Chile,
flying, you're
Argentina,
flying every day.
And then we did. Well, no, we did two. We did Sao Paulo, and then we did Curitiba in Brazil.
Yep.
And then we did. I think we did Mexico City, and then Guadalajara. And then home. So much fun. Yeah. Oh, my God.
So much traveling.
So much
fun.
Yeah. And it was just like to go to these places we'd never been.
Yeah.
And have like sold out shows of people going crazy. I mean, we had the same experience in Russia when we first went there. We played our first time in Moscow. We played like to 3,000 people.
Oh, my God.
And we were like, what is happening? It was so crazy. And we had to have like security, because the people, kids were, they went so nuts. It was like scary. We were like, ah,
yeah. I've had that happen in Brazil.
Yeah. Brazil goes nuts.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's beautiful. I mean, that's, I love being able to go to the other countries and experience the culture and the food and talk to the people. And it's sad when you go and they're like, don't go in those areas. And you're like, okay.
Yeah, I got mugged in Rio once.
Oh, okay, there you go.
And the promoter was like, yeah, don't go. And I'm like, And what did I do? Stupid Ryan.
Yeah.
It's fun times.
Oh, yeah. No, there are those moments you get robbed, you get, all that kind of stuff.
Crazy, man.
We had somebody once in Melbourne. I was asleep in our backstage room, and we were playing this club, and the backstage was kind of like up these back steps that were outside. And it's kind of exposed to the out, and I was in there, and I was passed out. I was asleep because I was so exhausted. And I guess somebody came in to the dressing room while I was sleeping and stole all of our, bunch of our stuff and then left.
no way.
I was conked out.
No.
And they just came in and took a bunch of stuff and boop. And then I woke up and there was
everything was gone.
It was noticeable. I was like, what the?
Did you take any horns?
No. I think all of our gear was on stage.
Took personal belongings.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
Oh my
they
God,
took my shoulder bag, which had a bunch of gear and tech stuff in it.
I hate that. Oh my God. Yeah. What year was that? You remember?
No idea. But it was the same show where somebody threw a prosthetic leg up on stage.
Oh my God, no way.
We're playing and it's hot, and then all of a sudden going whizzing by my head was something, and I look back and there at Matt Wong's his wedge is a leg. And I'm
all right.
What is that? And then there's a guy who's hopping towards one legged, hopping towards the front of the stage.
Oh my God.
And we're like, what the heck? And in Australia, the way that they did it at that club is they would stack the empty pint glasses at the front of the stage. So this guy tries to hop up on the stage to get his leg back, even though he's the one who threw it. And he falls over onto this big stack of glasses and cuts his arm wide open. And we're like, what is happening?
Yeah.
So he's got a rep. They're like, the security guys are sitting there with him while somebody comes to bandage his arm, and we're trying to get him his leg. He's like, sign it. And so we signed. Funny enough, not the first time we'd signed a prosthetic leg.
No kidding.
Mm-mm. We signed somebody's dead grandmother's prosthetic leg outside the back of the club, the Pageant in St. Louis. Yeah.
Oh my God.
But some guy's like, would you sign my dead grandmother's prosthetic leg? And I was like, I was like, 100%.
Dude.
You got it. It was old, and the foot at the bottom was the shoe that was an old wingtip shoe looking thing, and the foot that was in it was made of wood. It was so crazy.
That's fucking nuts.
Oh man, it was it felt really like American Horror Story.
Well, hey, we have to go to one more commercial break.
Yeah.
And when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about your departure from Real Big Fish into the Littlest Man Band.
Sure.
All right, we'll be right back with Scott Kloppenstein. I'm going to try something different now. Okay, we're back.
Right. I do love a good vibra slap. You know what I mean? You can't go
wrong. The fun
part
about being at your studio, there's all sorts of wacky
so much
toys.
Stuff. Yeah.
All right, so we're back. This is the conclusion of the interview. So, okay, so you're traveling all over the world. You just haven't stopped at this point.
No.
So what made you... I don't know if this is too personal, but
no.
What made you want to leave? And then, because you've been still doing, you haven't stopped doing music at all. But I mean, what made you start doing this more seriously and going? Because I love what you're doing now with the Littlest Man Band. And
Thank you.
It's a great project. Going into the tour with me playing drums, it was, probably one of the more challenging gigs that I've had in a long time. Just learning these songs, because there's not it's not like your average, 4/4 stuff. It's all the way through. There's it's really instrumental. And you're really paying attention to the story that you're telling too.
Yeah.
In your music. So
that was something I really learned from Aaron. Aaron was a great detailer. You listen to early Real Big Fish stuff, and there's a lot of details and riffs and counter melodies and things going on in there that that were just always so fascinating and interesting to me. But what kind of wound up happening? So the Littlest Man Band was something I did back in 2002 is when it kind of started.
Okay.
It was after Cheer Up. And I think Aaron was in a funky spot personally and artistically. And I kind of felt that. And so I was like, hey, I'm going to focus on, I want to do something else with some friends. I've got some songs. I had done Drunk Again and the song Average Man for Real Big Fish. And I was like, I kind of want to, I feel like I'm actually might be good at songwriting. And I'd really like to like get back focused on it. And so I was doing some things on my own, just demoing a bunch of stuff. And then a friend of mine named John Halpern, I was wearing this. Yeah, you know John.
He's great.
Yeah, I was wearing this little pin that said The Littlest Man, which was what I decided to name the project. Uh-huh. And a friend of mine had made like this little, it was like a little house with a tree and it just said, The Littlest Man.
What made you want to call it The Littlest Man Band out of every name in the world?
It's just something that popped into my head. There was no rhyme or reason to it. I mean, I work so much based on just whatever comes out. I don't judge. Mm-hmm. It's just whatever it is. And then I usually have to spend some time with it and dig out the truth of whatever it is. And so, yeah, I think it was my subconscious's kind of manifestation of an identity that was always kind of feeling like a side guy and not necessarily the most confident of front men.
I'll tell you this because here there's no denying this at all. I was a huge Real Big Fish fan growing up. I came to your guys' shows. I've watched you and I made a relationship with you guys on like what would have been my like fourth tour I ever did in like my entire life. I think that summer I hung out with like on Warped Tour, like O2, I think I hung out with you guys and like Something Corporate. Those are the two bands I just chilled with like the most. And I was going to say, I always looked at you as like the other guy in Real Big Fish. You know what I mean? So like when you left, there was you could definitely tell there was a shift in the way like songs were getting written, or there was, you know, or the way the performance was, at least for me.
Sure.
You know?
Well, I'm sure it was.
You were a huge part of that band.
Yeah. And I mean, and I was, you never see yourself the way that others do.
Sure.
And so I had a lot I wanted to say and hear musically that
obviously,
I knew.
Like Aaron was a singer, but like, right. I always thought of you as like the other guy.
Yeah.
You know?
And it's like, it just, I knew that, what I wanted to do wouldn't have been what Aaron wanted. And so I was like, and I respected that wholeheartedly. And so I was like, I wanted to do something of my own. So I got some of the guys from PAL and some of the guys, some other people and from the Scholars, and we started the Littlest Man Band and we recorded the record. And then when I moved to New York in 2005, the whole thing kind of fell apart. Cause I was ready to keep it going because we had started touring Europe and doing all sorts of stuff. But they were like, I don't see how we can do this when you live in New York. I was like, I'm here in California all the time. And I was like, and we can totally do it. Mm-hmm. But they all had a different lifestyle and understanding of what was possible. And so, you know, but then when my wife got pregnant with our first child, I had reached this point with touring and with the band where I didn't love it in the way that I needed to continue doing it. I mean, I'd been touring since I was 15 in different bands and stuff, and I needed to take a break.
Right.
Just to be a regular person, to see what it was like to be home, to be a husband to my wife, to raise my kids.
And you're still yet doing music full time.
You know,
it seems like, you
I mean,
know,
like, now I am. And it's not as easy.
No,
I mean, I'll tell you, I mean, it's like, and I quit. I mean, I quit playing. I didn't really pick up a guitar or do anything for almost 2 years after
That's wild, man.
I just took a break and got like normal guy jobs and did stuff. And then my best friend, Katia McMullen, who's a great writer and human being, got me to start working and doing theater stuff for her. She was a playwright and screenwriter, and so we did that kind of stuff. And so when I was in New York, I mostly did theater composing and songwriting for concert plays and stuff.
I
like
love that. That's great.
It was rad. It was fun. Yeah. And then when we moved back to Southern California in July of 2020 during the pandemic.
That's really great. I was just going to say, you know, we only have like, 4 minutes left.
Oh, Jiminy.
I know. Isn't that crazy how fast this is all?
Super fast.
This is all gone. But I'm so glad you moved back, man, because I was like, you know, I hadn't talked to you for a while, and I reconnected with you over a Christmas party.
At John's.
Yeah. It was great.
Yeah.
You know, that was like last, no, it wasn't last year, was it?
That was not this last Christmas, yeah, this, but the Christmas before.
This is crazy. That literally feels like yesterday to me.
Yeah.
But I'm so happy you're back. And I was just gonna say, so since you moved back to California, I mean, you've picked this right back up, and you're starting to like do more shows, and I got to do those with you. And
yeah.
So rad, and we'll have to do more.
Heck
sometime
yeah.
Down the line.
Yeah, there's more music coming. Yeah. I mean, we've got more, you know, and then we've got the Twitch show, which happens every Tuesday and Friday at 9 p.m., and then the Wednesday and Thursday shows are at 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time.
So you're like on a schedule with the,
yeah,
the
Twitch
band.
Is a schedule, crazy. And it's like we'll probably be doing Twitch stuff from the road.
Cool.
Because it's easy to do.
I love that, man. Yeah. I mean, for anybody that's trying to get started with trying to do a band from the ground up these days, what advice would you give them with the 2 minutes we have
just
left?
That nobody knows what they're doing. I mean, it's really like you got to just throw everything at it. You know, the landscape has changed so much since I started doing this that it, never get fixed in one place. You just always have to be malleable, and no idea is a bad idea until you realize it doesn't work, and then you discard it and move on. Like, okay. That's the whole thing. That's music, that's art, that's life. It's like, try everything, and if it doesn't work, okay, great, move on.
I was going to say, you know, I've said this on all my episodes, but I was going to say 9 times out of 10, bands fail. And the 1 in 10 that don't were the ones that were too stupid to stop.
Yeah, amen
so
to that.
That's you, that's me, that's everybody that we've jammed with and played with over the years, you know?
Yeah.
I refuse to quit.
Oh, I can't.
I can't.
I'm not
can't
qualified
imagine,
to do anything
I'm
else.
Neither. I'm just, this is all, this is literally
I mean,
all I
know. I've thought about teaching, but I don't know that anybody would want to listen to me talk for that long.
What's special about doing this show with you, though, is like, I mean, dude, you've literally known me since I was like a teenager.
Oh, I remember when we first met, and I was like, "Look at this baby boy!"
And you never knew. Like, no one knows if you're going to do this for the long haul. If you're like in and out, or like whatever, you know. So it's like, I don't know. It's just, it's really cool. It's kind of like full circle moment.
Oh, I mean, when G. Scott was like, "We should get Ryan Seaman," I was like, "Why the heck wouldn't we? My God!"
I love that, man. Yeah, I just. Yeah, it's really cool to jam. I mean, even you know, my first oh my god moment before this is over. I think the first time I ever played.
You can edit out a bunch of us. I
yeah,
put a
true.
Lot of those
yeah,
in.
Yep, you're right. I can't do that. But what I was going to say is going on a final note. You guys were the first band that got me to play in front of a huge sea of people. I sat in with you guys on the song Take on Me.
Oh, right.
I got really shit. Well, Aaron and I got really shit faced. I was like, hey, that, you know, I don't know even know how it came up, but it somehow the next day I got to play Take on Me with you guys. I was talking, he's like, oh, you got to ask Carlos, but I don't give a shit. Come up on stage, hang out with us, just play, blah, blah. I'm like, hey, Carlos, can I, you know, and he let me.
And Carlos is so amicable, he's just like, oh, yeah.
I did it like 4 more times. And then before we go, I also learned recently that fucking, this is like a whole nother conversation, but like Carlos's children are in the Linda Lindas.
That's amazing. It's crazy. Yeah.
It is such a small world vibe out in California.
Yeah.
I mean, I moved out here after that Warped Tour. I just was like, yep, I got to go to LA.
Got to go.
This is it.
It really is.
Scott, thank you. Thank you so much. If people want to find you on the internet, what's like the best
You can find me on the Instagrams at Scott Allen Kloppenstein. I don't know. Maybe.
I think it's just your name.
I think it's just Scott Kloppenstein. Yeah. I mean, you can also find the Littlest Man Band. Same on TikTok. It's just the Littlest Man Band. My Twitter is S.A. Kloppenstein, I think. But yeah, I mean, we're all over the place and doing always busy.
I can't wait to hear
and then,
more
yeah,
music.
On Twitch, it's Scott Kloppenstein.
Great. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much again. Coming up next is Gone Fishkin here on Adobe. And I'll see you next Thursday at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 o'clock Pacific. Every single Thursday, I put out a new show. So, Scott, thanks again for making time for me.
Thank
I really
you,
appreciate
sir.
It. All right. We'll see you next time.
See you, gang.